Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I thank you for joining us for what I believe is our last regular podcast of the season. Now, we will be having podcasts throughout the World Cup. I will not be hosting them because, obviously, I will be in Russia. And a week from Thursday, we're going to have a special World Cup preview edition where I will be there, but as a pundit. Somebody else will be hosting it. That name to be revealed later. And so for all of those who are like, Gab, you're such a bully when you host it. Well, why don't you let Scully talk more? Stop interrupting people, blah, blah, blah. You'd be better as a pundit. Well, yeah, you'll get to experience me as a pundit. And you can tell me if you like that better or not. In the studio with me today, it's former Leicester City, Crystal Palace, England under 21 striker, James Scowcroft. And
Coventry, who have a big game today.
And Coventry, yeah. Then you also play for Ipswich, too. There
I
you
did,
go.
Yeah, I mean, Ipswich aren't playing today. Coventry aren't taking 40,000 fans to Wembley, so hopefully when you're at this, they will be promoted.
Down the line, we have the football correspondent for the Sunday Times. It's Jonathan Northcroft, who I last was hanging with in Kiev in a bar around 5 o'clock in the morning on Sunday. So I'm glad he made it back okay, Jonathan.
Yeah, back okay, but still feel slightly in midair, if you know what I mean.
I think we all do. Later on, we're going to be issuing our report cards for every Premier League team this season. Remember, we did the midterm reports, and these are going to be the final grades. Plus, we're going to be discussing the fact that Arsenal have a new manager. Yes, welcome, Unai Emery. But of course, obviously, there's only one place to start, and that's in Kiev with the Champions League final. Johnny, I'm going to start with you because I think probably more than any final in recent years, certainly of the ones I've been to, and I've been to a lot, I think this one was decided by individuals rather than the collective, both for good, Gareth Bale, and obviously for bad, Loris Karius, and you know sometimes for happenstance and injury, Mohamed Salah. Let's start with Salah. It's half an hour in. Liverpool have played really, really well to that stage. There's a clash with a coming together, I think is a term referees like to use, with Sergio Ramos. He falls on his shoulder and he tries to continue for a minute or so, but then it emerges he can't. Now, the latest, and this is a situation that's clearly evolving, it does appear like he will make the World Cup. Which is a positive. If Salah had stayed on the pitch, would Liverpool's chances of winning this game have increased substantially?
Oh, yeah, hugely. I mean, it's just something we'll never know, isn't it? But the first 25 minutes, all the things that you thought Liverpool might be able to do offensively were kind of coming true. You know, they were, I mean, the pressing was brilliant. They were targeting Casemiro in particular and getting a lot of joy from him. Also, Carvajal was, I think they sensed, you know, he was carrying an injury in the final. He wasn't quite himself, and I think they sensed weakness there. They were turning the ball over when he had it. And then Salah was escaping into that space behind Marcelo. And Marcelo, who one of my favourite Real Madrid players, I think he's brilliant. But I thought he was very inhibited while Salah was on the pitch because he didn't play his normal attacking game. He didn't seem to know whether he should be pushing up, and yet he still wasn't really policing Salah properly. So you could see where Liverpool's game plan lay. You could see where the joy might be for them. I mean, they didn't score in that period. And I think we all knew before the game that Liverpool would try one of these blitzkrieg starts that they do under Klopp. And when they do that, they tend to score a couple, and then, you know, the rest of the game follows the sort of the pattern of them, you know, trying to maybe protect it and score another on the counter. So that was always going to be their thing. So I think there was lots of encouragement for Liverpool, but the caveat is they hadn't scored. What we don't know is whether they'd blown themselves out energetically a little bit, and Real might have already weathered the storm and then could have taken control anyway, or whether the pattern would have continued and, you know, maybe like as against Roma in that first game, they could have scored 10 minutes from half-time and opened the floodgates then. So we're just not going to know.
In terms of the dynamic of the incident itself, was there malice on Ramos's part? Can you go and say, I blame Ramos for injuring Mohamed Salah? Because there is a petition out there, which as of last night would have gone past the 200,000. I mean, I know any Wally can put up a petition, and who knows how many of those people are bots or whatever who sign it. But there's a petition asking for some kind of mega retrospective punishment against Sergio Ramos. What was your take? Was there... Can you blame this on Ramos?
I think Ramos obviously is an experienced player. He knows what he's doing. He knows that he has to get tight to Salah. If you let him come off you and have 2 or 3 yards and he gets a run, and especially he can go both ways. So he's got tight to him, you know, literally, you know, grabbed him. But he's grabbed one arm, but he actually injures the other arm. This is what I don't sort of... It's not the arm that he's tugged that he actually injured.
He gets injured falling. He doesn't he didn't get injured from the tug to the arm.
So do you think, well, if I hold this arm here, you're going to, in 3 seconds' time, fall over and dislocate your shoulder? Then, yeah, I think it's sour grapes. I think it's very, very harsh to single out Ramos in that occasion and say, you've deliberately done this and, you know, ruined the game and killed Liverpool off. I just don't buy into that at all.
I spoke to another, like James, former professional about this, and I think the phrase he used was, it was within the bounds of what's acceptable. And I guess that's what it was. I think it was opportunist. I don't think Ramos planned, as James said, that, oh, I'm going to dislocate his shoulder now. I think when they locked arms, he saw the opportunity. Salah was off balance, was falling. And if you look at the replay, he just gives him a tug to help him on his way, just to make sure he lands heavily.
Because to me, it was to make sure that he goes down. In other words, that because, you know, he looks off balance and he's falling, but, you know, Salah, these guys are such athletes that maybe could regain his balance and get away.
But what he's done, he's been clever because he's got his arm, sorry, John, he's got his arm by his side, so it's... You can obviously see it clearly on TV, but there's nothing outstretched where it looks like he's grabbing him. So because he's locked him, it almost from a distance, a referee, well, who's sort of holding who here? So I just think it's a player who's very, very experienced and knows what he's doing.
I thought it was a bit like leaving your foot in a tackle where you know that it's acceptable. The tackle's fine. You're entitled to go for it. But you know that if you leave it in, it's just going to create a little bit of pain. And I just thought you know, I'll just give him a bit more of a tug just to make sure he falls heavily. I think one of the problems for people is his reaction. You know, he's seen laughing with the linesman, and that plays up to the evil villain aspect. But, you know, we should be judging him on the instant, really, and not a sort of social media clip of him smiling, shouldn't we?
He's a winner.
So all this petition and this nonsense is just that. It's sour grapes.
So if Harry Maguire, in a World Cup final, this hypothetical, playing Argentina, and it's a one-on-one, and he pulls down Higuain, for example, and he thought, are we going to have a petition in this country of over 200,000 signatures 2 days later after England won the World Cup?
Yeah, maybe from the Scots and Welshmen in this country, but probably not many others. Right. No, I would tend to agree with you. You know, he obviously pushes the rules. Nobody wants to see guys injuring other players intentionally, which...
Every manager I played for would die to have that kind of player in his side.
Who's a player like that that you played against?
Martin Keown.
Good one.
Martin was like that.
The other obviously big incident is Loris Karius. Two really big blunders. And even on the Bale overhead kick, he kind of makes it worse because he dives so... It's weird. I was talking to another goalkeeper, and he said, you know, when that happens, you should know. Don't dive. There's no way you're getting to it. You should know instantly. And he dives late, and it makes it worse because it looks like it's almost like behind him. But he said nobody in their right mind who knows anything about goalkeeping can blame Karius one bit for the Bale bicycle kick. The other two goals, on the other hand, wow. On the first one, he doesn't seem to see Benzema at all when he tries to roll the ball out to Dejan Lovren. And on the other one, Bale shoots from a million miles away. Doesn't even look to be that hard a shot. It's not like it was, you know, it's a howitzer. And he should easily collect it. And instead, it kind of comes off his hands and ends up throwing it into his own net. But
I'll give you a small example. As a centre forward, when you miss an open goal, the next two or three chances, if you get two or three chances in a game, trust me, you're very, very on edge. Your touch is very heavy. You're very likely to miss the next chance as well. That's what I found in my career.
Well, it's interesting. I'm going to submit something my ESPN colleague, Shaka Hislop, who was a played goalkeeper, put out there. And I want to get your reaction to it, Johnny. He made the point that, okay, so the first goal, he chalked up to the fact that maybe because of lack of experience, clearly Klopp had told them to, you know, play at a high tempo, keep the ball moving quickly, and so on. He says that he was so focused on, again, getting the ball back in. You know, it was a very manageable situation. He collected the ball, and all he could think about was just squaring and rolling the ball over to Lovren quickly so that they could restart, and didn't notice Benzema. And equally on the third goal, he said his body isn't in a position to stop the ball. His body's actually in a position to where he's going forward. I think he used the term straddle position, where he's getting ready to go and put the ball back in play before he even catches it. And he says, and it's just simply something that, you know, with more experience, when you know yourself better, you know the occasion better, you're not going to be affected by it. Does that seem plausible to you, Johnny?
Yeah, it does. What that makes me think of is a conversation I had with Dejan Lovren about, you know, the mistakes he's made for Liverpool. And he explained that Klopp demands such a positive front foot game. So if you take the defenders, he's always asking them to be as high as possible. And he's always asking them to be, at, you know, proactive, gamble them in the ball. So Lovren's made mistakes this season, as against Manchester United, by almost, you know, taking huge gambles to try and win balls and missing them and being exposed that way. So I think there's an element of that with Karius, that it's that positive game that they're being encouraged to play. But that said, you know, there's different ways you can explain it. It comes down to losing focus in a split second, and it comes down to mistakes that are just so unacceptable for goalkeepers that however you try and rationalise them, however sorry we feel for Karius, the simple fact is that cannot happen. That cannot happen, especially the first goal. It cannot happen, and it cannot happen in a game like that. Sad to say it, but that is the fail right there. That's there's no hiding place for Karius from that, and there's no hiding place, I guess, for Klopp, because it was his selection from a long way out that this was going to be his number one.
So in some ways, you're putting some of the responsibility of this on Klopp, not just obviously Definitely. For signing Karius and making him number one, but also creating that environment which encourages risk-taking, and which might have facilitated this.
I don't mind the risk-taking, because that's, you get the benefit, there's the reward that he gets from overall from having that game. I think where I would blame Klopp is that he created a very unusual situation with the goalkeepers. You know, he signed Karius, who became understudy to Mignolet, and then he became number one, and then he was dropped, he went back to being understudy, and then he went back to being number one over quite a short period of time, you know, 18 months, 24 months, whatever. And the only comparison I could think of, and he did a piece in one, a rival newspaper today, is Robert Green in the 2010 World Cup, when Fabio couldn't decide who his number one was going to be in the build-up to the tournament. He swapped between David James and Rob Green. He went with Rob Green in the World Cup, and I just think those, the biggest occasions have a way of finding out flaws, and it found out the flaw in England at that point, which was Rob Green wasn't either ready for being the number one, good enough for being number one, or too uncertain because he didn't feel he was being fully backed as number one. And he made that terrible mistake against the USA. And I think with Karius, it all came to a head on Saturday night. Over-promoted, not ready for that game in his career. And, you know, maybe not 100% secure in his position. And we saw what happened.
It seems that he had a difficult start, but it seemed like he was coming through that in his Liverpool career, that he may be showing signs of, similar to what De Gea had, he had a real tough start to his Manchester United career, really, but he's now sort of fallen so far back now. It's a long way for him to come and establish himself as Liverpool's number one. If Liverpool are going to be successful in the next few years, they need a solid, very good goal. It's almost your number one position now. If you look how Pep's addressed it at Manchester City this year with Edison in goal, he's almost come through and, you know, and established himself. And I think Liverpool need to do that now. They've stuck by him. It's a huge decision for Klopp now.
I want to ask about something else that got a lot of attention. There was a lot of criticism for the fact that after his blunders, Karius wasn't comforted immediately by Liverpool players. And people had to go at Jordan Henderson, like, you're the captain, you got to go pick your teammate up, blah, blah, blah. It's interesting because I saw this quote from Massimo Taibbi, who has obviously been there. And Scobie's not making a face, but I know that I'm traumatizing him with bad memories. And, you know, Taibbi, of course, famously made two big blunders in two games for Manchester United. He also played very well in a couple other games. He didn't play very many games for United, and people, everybody seems to forget that. But hey, but he said, you know what? When you do something like that, you know that you've made a big mistake. And it all depends on your personality. To some people, having a teammate come over and say, you know, chin up, we'll get them, blah, 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 makes a huge difference. With other people, the best thing to do is to leave them alone because nobody wants to be patronized when they know that they've screwed up. Johnny, my take is that Liverpool's teammates, and maybe I'm giving them an easy out here, they know Karius better than I do, and certainly better than any of us know. They've certainly seen him screw up in the past. And they said, you know, let's just leave the big fella alone. And this is how he sorts and let him just sort it out, rather than going over and saying something to him, because he knows that we're a team and we have his trust and he has our trust and whatever else. Is that the reading, or do you think that there is some sort of code of optics that says that they should have gone over and hugged it out?
I think this is an entirely confected controversy, a social media controversy based on people looking at the footage and not being there, not understanding the realities of the situation. I think it's exactly that. I think they're giving the guy some space. And I think if you know Liverpool in any way, one of the impressive things about where they are at this point is that I haven't seen such a unified, such a together squad at Liverpool in a long time of covering them, and a squad that doesn't have a particular hierarchy. Because in the past, there's always been a bit of a star system. At Liverpool, there's always been senior pros, there's always been people who are maybe a little bit bigger in their profile than others. And they are a pretty evenly kind of ranked bunch of lads who've got a very, you know, a captain that's not a superstar in Jordan Henderson. They are a close bunch, and I don't think you can question their I don't know, togetherness, their social aspect, on the basis of looking at some pictures of them not comforting Karius. I think they know him better than us, and they need to give him space.
Scully?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think from my experiences, players that have made mistakes, and that's me included, certainly I haven't experienced a Champions League final, but generally you sort of leave players alone, really, to, you know, gather their own thoughts. I think, do you really want 15, 20 players going over to you and hugging you and putting you know, it's just showing the whole world and highlighting the mistakes you've made. And like Johnny goes, you do not know what happens behind the scenes. You know that. I'm sure they would have had some kind of, I wouldn't call it a party, but a function afterwards where maybe, you know, the Hendersons and all that would have sat down with him and, you know, spent a lot of time with him. I think those are the moments that matter a lot more.
Word on Gareth Bale, he started on the bench a bit like Cardiff, except he covers, he came on around the hour mark. Unbelievable overhead kick. And then obviously then he had the other goal. But I want to ask you about it. He came out afterwards and almost unprompted, he says, well, you know, if I don't get enough playing time here, if I'm not playing on a regular basis, I'm going to have to consider my future. Struck me as something like, is that really the time to say it? Do you need to tell the world that? You can go on social media the next day and say it or whatever. Do you blame him for this, or should he just waited for a different time to say this? And if he does move, do you think there's really a taker for him?
Well, I don't blame him. It's kind of what makes Real Madrid Real Madrid. The rules are different there. And you'll need to look at Zidane's post-match press conference where the guy's just won his third Champions League in a row. He's just created history. And he wasn't even asked about that. He was asked about, what about Cristiano? What about Gareth Bale? Look at what he said. You know, it's life at Real Madrid. So you got to see it within that context. Before Saturday, I thought, who's going to buy Gareth Bale? Not you know, he's brilliant, so I didn't think that on the basis of ability. I just thought, he's too expensive. You know, there's been injuries. He's now late 20s. Even if he wants to move, he might be kind of trapped because, you know, the wages are huge. The transfer fee would be incredible. I just can't see it happening. And also, the likeliest return would be to England. The two clubs that could really afford in the Manchester clubs looked to be going in different directions. But I wonder if it's just changed now because of Saturday night. And I wonder if the change will be Manchester United, because a couple of things. Ed Woodward has always wanted to sign Gareth Bale. You've seen him from a long way off as you know, Ed loves the Galactico model, kind of wants Man United to be like that, and seeing Bale as that as a Galactico that would be perfect for us. And that performance was a glint of what Gareth Bale still got to offer in football. And coming off the back of United's poor end to the season, I just wonder if the two things might come together. And although it doesn't make any sense in the context of already signing Alexis and spending all the money on attackers so far, I just wonder. I'm not saying this on any, you know, inside knowledge of transfer fans as of today, but I know that over the longer period, it's something Woodward's always wanted to do. So I just wonder if that's.
Bale currently earns in excess of 400 grand a week. So should he come to United, he would be the highest paid player. Presumably he'd get another pay rise. It's a long-term contract. It would be a big fee. Obviously United, even in an age of financial fair play, given their revenue, they can certainly spend money, certainly more freely, I think, than City even, if they think it adds something. Does the prospect of a Bale, Lukaku, Alexis front line with Pogba in behind, does that stimulate you when you think that maybe this summer, maybe they can, you know, Mata will possibly move on, Martial they can move on, you got Rashford and Lingard on the bench, does that get you excited?
I think certainly 3 years ago, 4 years ago, Gareth Bale was as good as anybody there was out there. For whatever reasons, it hasn't worked in the last 2 or 3 years at Madrid, and for this to be a constant substitution, there's something that doesn't add up. What I'd say about Manchester United, I don't think it's that far. They are desperate for a left-sided player. Desperate for, even though they've got Sanchez and everything, they are. I know for a fact that they're looking for a left-sided left-winger. I think it would be a good move, and I think he's a kind of player that's got a point to prove, knows the Premier League, knows the demands, and I think it would, at his age, he's got experience behind him now, he's played for the biggest club in the world, I think he'd come to the Premier League, and I think he could have two or three very, very good seasons. And if they were at Manchester United, fantastic.
Love the game? Then don't miss The Game Daily. It's your lunchtime update from football's finest writers, and it's only at thetimes.co.uk. We have a new manager at Arsenal, Unai Emery. It's funny because it's been a week. This is not what we expected. Last week, we're all talking Arteta because it certainly looked that way. Johnny, I'm a little bit confused here
They said that it was unanimous and it came after a thorough search. And certainly several outlets reported that Arteta withdrew because he wanted assurances over transfers. Is this sour grapes from Arteta? Who do you believe here? Are there Pinocchios on all sides, as is often the case in football?
Yeah, I think that's it. I don't believe that this was the target that they had in mind from the moment that Arsene left. I think the other options on the table were we know about them, and I don't think Emery was one of those at that time. I think he's come late into it, and I think that a process that began with them promising to be bold ended predictably with them going for a much safer option when push came to shove, and Emery was right place at the right time to capitalise and get the job because of that.
Scully, Johnny called it a safe choice there. I think what you're getting with Emery is somebody who achieved wonders, nothing short of wonders, both at Seville and at Valencia. And he did it in difficult situations. He did it with difficult interfering owners, especially at Valencia. He did it in situations where his best players were being sold every year. So it wasn't really, you can't really build a team, right? When you say, I'm going to build around this guy, and then the guy's gone the next year, and you got to kind of start over. And that really marked, and before that, he'd done really well with limited resources at Lorca and Almeria. I wonder, is that guy, and I wonder where Arsenal are. I wonder if Arsenal are that sort of club where you have to scrap to some degree the way Valencia and Sevilla did, and, you know, he did win 3 Europa League titles. Or if they're a PSG-type club, or at least in that mold, where you can hang on to your best players year after year, there's still interference from above, there's still big egos, and in those situations, the fact is he did not win the title in his first season. He won a ton of domestic silverware, and then obviously, despite, I thought, performing well at times against both Barcelona and Real Madrid, you know, the fact of the matter is he went out of European competition. How do you see it?
I think it's an excellent appointment. I think if you look at him as a manager, like you said, the success he's had has been fantastic. So he's got experience of winning trophies. He's got experience of building sides, losing players and rebuilding, which I think Arsenal is a rebuilding job at the moment. But I also think the PSG experience will be just as valuable for him as well, because that's a difficult club to it's not an easy club, because you are buying players, you are building a squad for one competition, for one or two games per season where you are judged, and I think that's a very difficult one. And you have to handle players like Neymar and these guys, which are some of the hardest, most demanding players, when an owner says, oh, by the way, we're just about to smash all records in the transfer. Okay, right, I'll have to handle that. You know, he's a good age, and I think it's a perfect fit. I think he's a very good choice for manager for Arsenal.
Johnny, it does seem that on the back of what Scully said, which I broadly agree with, the Arsenal job, there's a ton less pressure than there is at Paris Saint-Germain, or even at Valencia, frankly, because if there's one thing that we know about, well, A, there's generally less pressure in the Premier League to begin with, apart from certain situations and at certain clubs. B, this is a fan base that, you know, for many years sat on its hands or was happy with Arsene Wenger, and that, you know, other than the folks in Arsenal Fan TV, they don't act up. They're not going to show up at the training ground to intimidate you. They're going to smash windows on your car. They are what they are. It's a better place to work in that sense. The bar is low. There don't seem to be any big problematic egos. Maybe Aubameyang, based on what we've seen in the past, but he seems to be happy just to be in the Premier League right now. Ideal working conditions, right?
Yeah, one of the things I like about the appointment as well is that they spent all this, they put this energy into creating a structure, a new Arsenal structure, you know, that's much more collegiate, based around different people running different departments, having input into you know, the end outcome. It's a kind of de facto director of football with a powerful chief scout, with chief exec Gazidis, who seems to want to play a bigger part in the football operation now. And they found a coach that can really work within that structure and isn't going to come in and you know, demand power straight away, which I think is one of the led to believe the problems with Arteta. So I like all that. You're right about the conditions. I think it's a red herring to say that he failed to control Neymar, so he can't control the Arsenal dressing room, there is no Neymar at all in that dressing room. Aubameyang, I think, actually, from what I understand from Dortmund, you know, we're not talking about a big flamboyant ego. You know, maybe we're just talking about a guy that turns up late to training sometimes, and you've got to be careful that way. Maybe I'm living in the past. Maybe Arsenal are a bit ahead of me in the thinking that they recognise that what they are at this point is a number six club that needs to move up the pecking order. And if that's how it is, that's a great appointment. If I guess I'm still thinking of Arsenal as a team that needs to start challenging for league titles. And I'm just not sure if Emery's the guy that's going to take them there.
We can go through this quickly because I didn't watch the game and I only watched highlights and I didn't watch them all season. So sorry, Championship. But Fulham have overcome Aston Villa and they will be joining us in the Premier League. Scoey, you're something of a Championship god. What do we expect? What are the prospects beyond Ryan Sessegnon?
Well, they've got some very good players, actually. More than Sessegnon, if Sessegnon stays, that is, of course, because I'm sure he's in demand for his age and his, you know, his goals he scored from fullback last year. I think it's a club that is well adapt to coming into the Premier League. I know it's, what was it, four seasons they've been out in the Premier League, but I think the structure behind the club, the manager certainly is very, very good. The football they play, the players they've got, I think they'll come into the Premier League. And I think they'll hold their own, no problem at all. And they have money.
I mean, they're bigger than individuals. I think even if they lost Sessegnon, they're well set up. They've got a really good manager who deserves to be in the Premier. He's obviously denied it with Watford when he took them up. You've got Tom Kearney, a bit of a, you know, Scottish hope for someone, something to fasten on to. Apart from Sessegnon, beautiful left foot. Decent players, but a really good style of football as well.
The right-back, like Fredericks, is a good player as well. Johnny. Mm-hmm.
Stefan Johansson's decent.
Yeah.
Good youth as well with Hugh Jennings. Maybe a bit more like a Bournemouth in terms of style of the team coming up. And they tend to do quite well, you know, when it's something that you can take forward and they don't have to go and sign another 20 players and start again in the Premier League.
What about my man Mitrovic?
Good question, because I think he was a sort of the player that they needed to. They've always played good football, but they needed that bit of punch to their attack, that, you know, strong, sort of aggressive player down the middle. They've got him. Certainly, if they'd want him, I don't think they'd have too much problem getting him. So maybe he has a point to prove as well.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go on to our Premier League report cards. Now, you've been given instructions. I hope that you're all prepared for this. I'm going to remind you of the grades. A means far exceeding expectations. B means above expectations. C, meeting expectations. D, subpar. And F is fail. Okay? We're going to start from the bottom and work our way up. I don't know that there's much to debate unless we have a strong difference of opinion. We will all submit our grades and then I will create an average of the three. So let's start at the very bottom. And remember, we're looking at the entire season. Not just how well Darren Moore has done and how much we like Darren Moore, but just in terms of how the club was run that season. John, let's start with you. West Bromwich Albion.
Yeah, Gav, just to get the parameters, just want to make doubly sure of this. We are taking in the whole season, not just Premier League performance. Yeah?
Absolutely, the entire season. Cool. And also the way the club has behaved off the pitch and so on.
Cool. Well, West Brom have to be a fail, sadly. Despite
there's not much of a debate. That's an F. That's a flat F. Flat F to the owners, flat F to the guy who loses his mobile phone and his wallet, all this nonsense. Scoey, are you also Straight F?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. That makes it very easy. Stoke. Scully?
F. Fail. Get relegated. Fail.
Okay. Johnny?
Yeah. Can't go past F.
Yeah, especially the way things seem to get worse and weren't, in my opinion, properly addressed. I'm going to give him a little kind of give him a D, but that's still an F. Swansea. Johnny.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's, again, has to be an F. There were periods where it was better than that, but I think that season went the same way as Renato Sanchez's, didn't it?
Yeah. I'm going to go, again, I'm going to be a little bit kinder here. I'm going to give them a D. I think they did kind of turn it around. They maybe made some mistakes sooner. I think they were also unfortunate in certain situations. Renato Sanchez is what he is. Scully?
Fail.
Oh, also F. Okay, great. Southampton. This is where it gets a little more interesting, a little more nuanced. Johnny?
Yeah, I think I was looking at an F because of Southampton's kind of expectations. But really, I'm going to give them a D because they finished the season looking like they've got something to build on for next season. Maybe the right manager to take them forward next season.
Yeah, I'm going to go D as well, subpar. I certainly expected them to do better. I expected Pellegrino to stick around a little more and make more of an impact. So I'm going to give him a D. Scully?
Fail.
I wouldn't want to be in Professor Scully's class.
Well,
yeah, that's fine.
If you look at
okay, well, this is a average
the team, the squad, the setup, the dynamics of the club. You look at their wage bill. The wage bill's in the top 10. To scrap and just stay up, I think that's a fail. I don't think that's subpar. I think it's a fail.
Huddersfield Town, Johnny.
I almost gave them an A, to be honest, but I give them a B. Above expectations, I thought they would go down. By far the I don't want to use the word worst. By far the least gifted squad in the division. So just to survive and had some thrilling days like against Man United on the way. So a B, almost an A.
Scully?
B. Isn't far exceeding expectations.
No. B, above expectations. We expected them to go down or be close. Instead, it was relatively safe.
And they got over the line.
To be fair, they did, after playing some very swashbuckling football early, they did sort of park the entire sort of Huddersfield Transit Authority bus system in their final games. But you know what? That's what was...
Fighting for their life, they should have played that's expensive what was required. Football, shouldn't they? Especially going to Chelsea.
Well, and, then why play? Well, why play it in the first place? You know why?
Terrible.
Why play it in the first place? Right? I mean, whatever. Yeah. They were right. They were pragmatic at the end, and they were proved right. Brighton and Hove Albion. Scully.
Gonna go C.
Really? This is what you expected of them?
Yeah, I think. All right. It's a club that's spent money.
Okay, I think you're wrong because they signed Pascal Gross, who's a very good player. I'm going to go B. Johnny?
Yeah, I'd agree with that, Gab. Yeah, B. Spent money, but spent it really well. You know, I mean, that's part of the season, isn't it?
Matt Ryan is a very good goalkeeper.
Can I let you two explain yourselves here? I think I need to explain myself here. I wouldn't say Brighton staying up for 50 is above expectation. I think if you're Brighton, you think, be good if we're in this position next year. I think staying up, you'd think it would be...
There's 7 points clear of relegation. They the players that they added, several of them, turned out to be hits and made a big difference.
That's what I'm saying. They've met expectation.
Well, I think that they're above expectations for me. So and we're the majority, so they get a B. Watford, Scully.
D.
Subpar. Johnny?
A bit harsh.
Oh, they had... Part of the season they were challenging for the top six or seven. Part of the season they were threatened with relegation. They changed their manager. That's exactly what you'd expect from a Watford season. C.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that C as well. And let's not forget also the business with the manager. The way they were able to kind of metabolize that and not get knocked off their stride for too long.
Different rules. They worked to different rules, Watford, don't they?
I think it's a really well-run club in many ways. West Ham United, Scully.
I'd say C.
Okay.
I'm going to go D because of the embarrassment that the unholy trinity provides, because of the signings they made, because of the absurd way the club was run, and then because, I mean,
it's West Ham, though, isn't it? That's norm.
I don't know. The West Ham deserve better. I'm going to go D.
I'm going to go D as well. All those reasons, you know, they're no closer, in fact, they're further away from their pretension of becoming some kind of force in the stadium, blah, blah, blah. They're starting again. They need to completely revamp that squad. D.
Bournemouth, Scully.
C.
Really?
Yeah, I think
this is what you expect of Bournemouth.
I think you'd be disappointed if they got relegated. I think transfer-wise, they probably don't spend the money that some teams do. But, you know, if you look closely into it, the deals that they've given Jermaine Defoe, and, you know, they do spend money in other ways. And I think finishing 12th, just over 40 points, is probably norm for them.
I expected them to either get relegated or be in a relegation scrap. The fact that they weren't means that I'm giving them a B. Johnny?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Scurry, but there'd be a case for a B minus or a C plus. With about six or seven games to go, they were certainly looking like a B, but they, you know, didn't quite push on at the end. I guess it's a compliment to them. I don't expect them to get relegated at all. So I don't see surviving as the achievement that maybe I should, but anyway, C.
Palace, Scurry.
C. I think if you look now, they're established. If you look at their squad, they've invested heavily in their squad as well. Their wage bill is quite high. To finish 11th, there's an argument that you could say, well, I didn't have any points after seven games, and Roy Hodgson was manager of the season. But I think overall, the bigger picture is...
Well, they did appoint the numpty to begin with, so, you know. Johnny?
Well, seven games later, they scored a goal. First seven games are an F. To then survive comfortably is an A, but so you give them a C, I think.
Yeah, I'll go with that. Newcastle United.
I'm going to go B.
B? Okay. I'm going to go A because this is not a good squad, and I think it was a yeoman effort by everybody.
And Rafa's your mate.
No, he's not as rough as my mate, but I mean, I think he did a great job, but I mean, look at these players. Johnny?
Yeah, I mean, I've only given one A, and it's not them. So I thought about it for them for exactly those reasons. It's a poor squad. There's political problems, and they hit 10th, which is brilliant. But I want to keep A, you know, for
right.
Spectacular, and it's not spectacular.
So this will average out to a B plus for them then. Leicester City, your old club, Scully.
Going to go C. I think if you look at Leicester now, it's a difficult one with Leicester, isn't it? Because they won the league three seasons ago. For me, it's a club that's trying to sort of find their identity. Are we amongst the pack where we're just trying to survive and get to 40, maybe 50 points if we're lucky? Or no, we won the league a couple of years, we're trying to kick on. And so I think overall, if you look at the spectrum of how high they actually could finish, maximum's probably only 7th, and they finished 9th, so C.
Okay, I'm on board with that. Johnny?
Yeah, I'm on board. I think, as Scurry says, Leicester have kind of got to rationalise where they are at the moment, and they've got to accept maybe that this is a pretty decent sort of par season, but there's angst because of what's gone before that maybe things should be better, more entertaining. But for me, a C.
Everton, Johnny?
F. Fail. Okay. Fail. If we're taking Europe into it as well, that Europa League campaign was humiliating. Much of the season was humiliating. I know, you know, there's the gloss of the eighth place finish, but really this
it's
is a
real
club
glossy that, there, isn't it? Finishing
well, this is exactly, you're right, Gab. It's not glossy, is it? But some people might want to say it. Oh, they're eight. That's great. No, it's not. They thought they were going to make a serious move the dial this year, be a serious challenger in some senses, and it
going
miles.
Fail.
Okay. I'll give them a D because things got a little better. But yeah, it's still horrible. Burnley, I think this one should be quick because I'm assuming we would all agree on this one. Or maybe not. Scully.
I think it's you can't really go of anything else, can you? I think to finish seventh, I think it's a fantastic achievement.
I'm going to go A as well. Johnny?
They are my A, brilliant season.
Arsenal, Scully.
D.
Okay. I might go further and go F because, I mean, I would say maybe, I know, I'll go D as well because they were so far ahead of Burnley and in the end, and they did go deep in the Europa League and whatever, but not good.
Nah.
F?
F.
D minus then. Sorry, Arsenal.
Yeah. Awful season.
Chelsea.
Get the champions and then not qualify for the Champions League. I think that's a fail. And I think that will be interesting in the next move now, Chelsea.
They did win the FA Cup, and they did come close to against Barcelona, I thought. But hey, so for those reasons, I'm going to say D.
What, you think a team that wins the league and the following season doesn't qualify for the Champions League, you're just saying it's a bit subpar?
Not a bit subpar. They were substantially subpar.
Well,
but
it's a
they
fail
won,
then, isn't
they
it?
Won the FA Cup. And
do you cover the FA Cup anymore?
Stop it. Johnny?
I'm with you, Gab. The FA Cup, redeemed themselves a little bit at the end. Did well in Europe-ish.
And he had one shot in the final.
Just stop it. Liverpool finished fourth. You're losing Champions League finalists. Scully?
C.
Johnny?
Oh, B. They did get the Champions League final.
I'd go B plus or something because I think
they how built much money something. Liverpool have spent.
They had okay. Listen, this is I see you've been reading Duncan Castle's tweet. I'll say, don't talk about spend, fella. Talk about net spend. Talk about wage bill. Talk about Karius. Talk about injuries. Talk about Trent Alexander-Arnold. Talk about Nathaniel Klein. Talk about Coutinho leaving in mid-season. Let's talk about all that, okay? Before we just go and say, look how much they spent, okay? Let's talk about Naby Keita not coming. Let's talk about Coutinho staying and not being happy about it. Let's talk about all these things if we're going to talk about it, okay?
Well, and then please. Let's talk about it then.
No, let's not.
Let's talk about spending £75 million on a centre-half, £40 million on a player that even you admitted to me won't be a huge success and is very surprised how it's turned out for him at Liverpool.
So that makes it bad?
No, no, it's bad. But it's a team that, A, spends money, has a high wage bill.
Has a high wage bill relic compared to who? Good, no, honestly, because when I look at the top six, right, I only see one team.
They've got the fourth highest wage bill in the league, so they finished fourth.
They don't have the fourth highest.
You think United, City, Chelsea, Liverpool.
No, I think you'll find Arsenal's wage bill is higher than Liverpool's. Yeah, so Liverpool ended up getting a B thanks to our interventions. They reached the freaking Champions League final, that thing that you watch on TV. Come on.
Goal kick with Teflon gloves on.
Tottenham Hotspur and my man, Poch. Come on now. Come on. Show some love. Scully.
B.
They're above expectations. Johnny.
See, but that's a compliment. I expect them to be really good. They're
you expect
really
them to
good.
Finish third?
Well, they finished second twice, didn't they? I thought that was a really good season, but I expect that, I suppose, now.
I'm going to go C so that we can end up giving them... I'm going to go B so we can end up giving them a B minus. I did not expect them this season to finish third. Sorry. And I think they played some very good football as well. Manchester United. Johnny.
D. If we're taking in everything, set themselves up as a team that has to win trophies, didn't win one. 8 more points than last year, whatever. 14 more points, whatever it was, isn't enough to justify what they've spent. So it was a poor season.
Yeah, I'm going to go D as well. The fact that there's forward momentum in some ways, but then you talk to United fans and they tell you the number of new players that they need. You talk to Mourinho, they drop in the number of new players they need. And kind of like, you're obviously not progressing at the speed that you would like to progress. And then there's Seville, which we won't get into. Scully.
Let's see.
This was your expectation for...
They finished second, and I think, you know, if you look where they were 2 years ago, where they didn't even finish in the top four, there is progression being made, whether you like it or not, and you hate Manchester United, there is a small, you know, I know it's the AB, anyone but United, but
is that like
I would
at
say
all?
It's meeting expectation. Is it subpar? No, B. above expectation? No. See,
I expected them to be better. I expected them to be further along. I expected the players that he spent money on to have made further projects. I don't think he's happy with it. And I don't think he would give himself a C, personally. And because my God, Mourinho doesn't give himself a C, then for that reason, I can't give him a C either. Manchester City. Scully.
B.
Okay, I think I'll be in the minority here again. Johnny.
Yeah, B, because we're taking Europe into it as well. Yeah, so they would have expected to beat Liverpool, wouldn't they, in that time?
And Wigan.
I'm going to give them an A because of the way they won the Premier League. Obviously disappointing against Liverpool, but the football they play. And yes, they've got all, they spent all this money. They have a very high wage bill. They freaking set records. They broke records, okay, with that very high wage bill. And they played unbelievable football. So for my money, I'm going to give them an A. But because you guys don't like them, they had a B+. Top of the class, the stars of the show, straight A students. Well done, Sean Dyche. Burnley, you get an A. And this concludes our Premier League report cards for the 2017-18 season. That's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my excellent guests, James Scowcroft and Jonathan Northcroft. Many, many thanks to our producer, Charlie, who makes it all happen. He's very good. Remember, if you want to read our newspaper, we're going to have some excellent World Cup coverage this summer. Just pay £8 and you get an 8-week trial. Not only do you get our excellent sports coverage, if you want something a little different, you also get the Sunday Times. Some of which, especially Johnny Northcroft's writing, is very, very good. Now, we're going to be back next Thursday with a special World Cup preview podcast. I won't be presenting it. Do not be alarmed. I will still be there as a pundit. Somebody else will. And please feel free to spend the next 10 days speculating on the identity of the next mystery host.
You could be a presenter's worst nightmare.
Why?
Because you'll cut in, you'll butt in, you won't agree with the running of the show, the points being made. No, I disagree with that, and you'll just put it off.
It's kind of a pundit's job to disagree and to speak up. Anyway, thank you all. You've been a tremendous audience all year. Thank you for your support, and till next time. Bye-bye.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.